Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On Friday, October 19th, the Norris Group proudly presents its fifth annual award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joins Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Foreclosure Radar and Sean O'Toole, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, and President Bill Tan, Investors Workshops and President Sean Watkins and Angel Bronskiest, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry, Fry Wiles, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. Learn more about the panel and how to attend at isurvivedrealestate.com.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Christopher Thornburg. Christopher is founding partner of Beacon Economics, LLC, and widely considered to be one of California's leading economists, an expert in economic forecasting, regional economics, economic policy, and real estate and industry economics. He was one of the earliest and most adamant predictors of the global economic recession that began in 2008. Since 2006, Dr. Thornburg has served on the advisory board of Wall Street hedge fund Paulson & Company, Inc. Between 2008 and 2012, he served as a chief economic advisor to the California State Comptroller's Office and was the chair of Comptroller John Chang's Council of Economic Advisors. Dr. Thornburg holds a Ph.D. in business economics from the Anderson School at UCLA and a B.S. in business administration from the State University of New York at Buffalo. Christopher, welcome back to our show.
Great to be here.
Are you comfortable with the direction of the U.S. economy?
I am.
I know you are.
It's funny. There seems to be this need in the popular press today to continue to beat this drum of decline when you look at the data, it's quite far from the opposite. We're 3 years into the current expansion. Numbers look okay pretty much across the board within the private sector. The weakest part of the U.S. economy overall is the public sector. And you subtract that out, you would argue this is almost a kind of a normal expansion.
If you wanted expansion, though, wouldn't it be in the public sector?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is over the long term, the government spending tends to grow more or less in proportion to the rest of the U.S. economy.
Okay.
And therefore is a contributor to overall economic output growth, at least from the demand framework that we typically use when we're examining the macroeconomy. Now, you are correct. There are many among us who believe that a smaller government is better. And from that perspective, you would look at these current statistics and you would say these are good things. And ultimately, you may be right. If we continue to see the public sector downgraded and people feel that that is a hindrance to the economy, ultimately you would suggest that that will bring better growth rates at some point in time in the future. But in the short run, when you shrink government, it's a drag on the economy. It's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that you can shrink the government right now and promote greater economic growth right now, well, that's just false. That's not how it works. You are creating structural transitions inside the economy, and those are painful in the short run.
Well, interesting. Over across the seas, that they're kind of having an exaggerated example of what you're saying. They want to cut back and expand the economy at the same time, and it's very difficult to accomplish both of those.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I would argue, however, that it's not quite the same thing. We have heard lots of, you know, the new insult in politics is calling you Greece, right?
Right.
You know, oh, yeah, California is just like Greece.
Mm-hmm.
Obama's turning the nation into Greece. we're not anything like Greece. I mean, Greece is where it is because for years it was vastly overborrowing. It had a level of debt relative to its economic output that's at one point in time at least twice, if not over that, larger than the U.S. economy. And on top of everything else, the Greek economy, the underlying Greek private sector economy, is one of the least competitive, least efficient in the world because of all sorts of crazy rules, regulations, and corruption, unlike the United States, which still has one of the most competitive private sectors in the global economy today.
How do you interpret having a 1.7% 10-year T-bill? What does that indicate to you?
It says two things. A, people are willing to pay a premium for safety, and B, they continue to see the U.S. government as a place for safety. That is to say, they fully expect that the money they give the federal government today will eventually be paid back to them.
So it's sort of saying we're afraid, we're concerned, and we're conservative, and yield isn't the big thing. Just can I get my money back at some point?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to simplify things, I mean, I think we both know that the world's more complicated than this, but, you know, there are two kinds of assets in the world today. There is what you would call safe assets and risk assets. The demand for safe assets is enormous today. And, you know, that's not just driving interest rates on T-bills. I mean, look at mortgage rates. Mortgage rates are incredibly low right now because people are willing to buy Fannie and Freddie bonds for very low rates. If you're a large global corporation, you can borrow at incredibly cheap rates because you are considered to be safe. So there's just a lot more demand than there is supply for those type of assets, and that's what pushes interest rates to where they are.
I'm just curious, where does California real estate fit into the risk quotient?
It should be very good. And, of course, I would argue that you're seeing money moving into California real estate at both the commercial and the residential level. We know cap rates are down, not just for apartments. They're starting to slip in terms of Class A properties and retail and office as well. And, of course, the housing market here is really starting to tighten up. Bruce, I know you've been counseling for a while that people should be moving heavy and hard into residential real estate, and I think the recent numbers show that you are absolutely right.
You know what's interesting is some of the hedge funds have recently moved some serious money into California and some other states that have had downturns. And this is a brand new occurrence for real estate, for housing anyway, to have that kind of money interested in setting aside not apartment buildings, well, not just apartment buildings, but now scattered homes that would be equivalent to apartment buildings, and with the intent of maybe putting together a REIT.
Yes, I've seen some of that stuff, and I do think it's probably a pretty good financial plan. What you're dealing with here, of course, is two things. A, California still lacks housing supply. Over the last 20 years, the state, for a variety of reasons, hasn't come anywhere close to producing the quantity of new homes necessary for population growth. And that's one of the reasons why we never took the same hit that, say, Vegas or Arizona did. We didn't have this vast excess supply that those other economies did in terms of the housing. But, of course, at the same time, there's something else going on out there, and that is this enormous wave of foreclosures. Most of the new demand in the U.S. overall, and of course here in California, is in fact moving not into owner-occupied housing, but rather moving into rental housing. Mm-hmm. And so as a result of that, people see that there's a good potential to buy these homes in the short run, rent them out, because we know there's a lot of demand. But then ultimately, of course, you can turn around and flip those things and make some good money selling them when the market shifts back towards a more focused owner-occupied type demand situation.
When you have an economic downturn like we had, does that stunt household creation?
Not really. I mean, you've heard that theory. I've heard some folks I think the Harvard Joint Center for Real Estate Studies.
I read it.
said that there's this vast pent up supply of 20-year-olds desperately trying to get out of their parents' home. I would point out that the Joint Center is also the same folks who, in 2006 and 2007, told us that there was no excess supply of housing and prices will go up forever. So I
read that one too.
To say I listened to them, it would be not true.
Well, I read it.
And when you sit down and look at the numbers, yeah, there was some modest evidence of doubling up, but it was pretty small. I think you could say the lack of household formation, the slowing of household formation, was really in part economic to some small extent. But just as much, we got to keep in mind that my feeling is between 2002 and 2006, we actually had an excess supply of new households. Because what you had is you had a lot of people, say 27-year-olds who would typically be living with a roommate in an apartment, say in downtown LA, living the young hip lifestyle. But those folks were instead going out and buying homes because they could, right? The money was there. It seemed like a path to quick riches, and they took the chance. Most of them, of course, probably got foreclosed on, and they're back living in the apartment they would have lived in anyway, but for the bubble. And so those folks, I would argue, was an excess supply in the short run, and that part's starting to turn around now. So
okay. 2013 and the fiscal cliff, is it real?
Well, I'm going to stop you right there because, we've heard this term fiscal cliff how many times? There's no such thing.
Okay.
There's no such thing as a fiscal cliff, and let me explain why. The concept of fiscal cliff sounds as if on January 1st, taxes go up, spending goes down, January 2nd, we're in a recession. It's a cliff, right?
Right.
No, it's not really a fiscal cliff. What I would call it is a fiscal hill. The difference is this. For a shock to the U.S. economy to have recession-causing effects, that shock has to be large, has to be rapid, and also just as important, and has to be sustained. The fiscal cliff is certainly large and certainly rapid, but it has to be sustained for it to cause a recession. And the reason that I'm relatively confident it will not cause a recession is because I remember what happened back in the mid-90s when Newt Gingrich and company, in the midst of their partisan battles with Bill Clinton, decided to shut down the federal government for a period of time over the budget that they didn't approve of. It's funny how Americans can seem so oblivious to the public sector and what's going on in our state capital, our federal capital. They could seem to be far more inclined with whatever star is doing whatever horrendous thing and whatever, paparazzi filmed scandal. Until, of course, the checks stop going out.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly they start paying attention in a very loud way. And we saw that in 1995. Within 2 to 3 weeks, the political crescendo was deafening. People were infuriated. It single-handedly led to the Republicans losing the House, the collapse of the whatever Gingrich's, pledge to America, promise to America, whatever it was, and the collapse of that whole movement, and ultimately made the rest of Clinton's stay in the White House much more, shall we say, easy for him. My feeling is January 1st, it seems highly probable we will not have a compromise by then. But even so, you can expect that when those checks stop going out, when those taxes start going up, you're going to hear an enormous outcry, and that pressure is going to continue to ratchet up, until such point in time when they realize that they have to do something. It's their neck on the line, and something will be accomplished.
Well, do we have to get closer in line with a balanced budget?
Ultimately, we have big problems in our budget.
Okay. Well, that
we know that. We have problems with Medicare. We have problems with Social Security. We have problems, candidly, with defense spending. That's all obvious.
When does that show up?
10 years.
Okay.
15 years. Not now, by any stretch of the imagination.
We'd be better off if we started dealing with it now, but we probably aren't. Is that...
Sadly, that's probably the case.
Okay.
And you know, we do need to start dealing with it. We need to start dealing with it at many levels. And we haven't had these conversations yet. And I can speak, for one, to be very frustrated with the fact that we keep ignoring the issues as obvious as they are. At the same time, however, I can tell you this. We're not going to solve this with partisan lines being drawn in the sand.
Exactly.
You know, you got one side of the equation, the Tea Partiers, who, you know, are screaming all sorts of crazy stuff. And then the other side, you got Nancy Pelosi and company saying, you know, Medicare is sacrosanct and you can't touch it no matter what. That's not how we solve these issues.
Well, there's another issue, and that's, you know, with state insolvency, where you have Chapter 9 bankruptcy, I think it is, and one of the things that seems to be virtually untouchable is people's retirement plans.
Yeah, at this point in time, that does seem to be the case. But again, one of the reasons they can get away with that in the short run is because of the fact that, again, the pain hasn't kicked in. There will come a point in time when CalPERS becomes so underfunded that they're going to have to acknowledge the obvious, and one of two things are going to happen. Either A, they're going to start passing those costs on to current employees by raising up their contributions a massive amount. B, they're going to send giant tax bills to government, state, and local level, which is going to create a taxpayer revolt. Or C, they're going to have to figure out some way of breaking that logjam, which is to say, they're going to have to find some legal way of reducing the benefits of people currently being paid. You know, sadly, the people who are probably most to blame for this issue are the sort of people already in retirement who will probably not even be there when we come to that point in time, which is too bad. Because these are the folks, you know, the folks who spiked their pensions, who are making ridiculous amounts for 40 years, who are going to get away with it scot-free, and it's going to be the current state and local public employees who ultimately left holding the bag, because they'll be paying for years and years, and they won't get anything close to what they were promised, because it's simply not sustainable. That, again, goes back to this argument that we need to do something about this now, but sadly, there's no possible way of doing that within this typical political climate. Now, I will say that we have moved incrementally in the right direction. Obviously, you had the governor do some modest reforms, obviously very small and not enough for the long-run standpoint, but at least he's moving in the right direction. What worries me to death is we had a very similar thing happen in the early 90s with Pete Wilson. He understood the long-term problems. He moved in aggressively to take care of them. And then, of course, we had the internet boom. We had the big surge in revenues, and Gray Davis came in and quite cavalierly reversed everything that Pete Wilson had done and made it worse. You know, I let me just say this here, too. You know, we see Gray Davis wandering around California like this elder statesman. I put the blame for our current budget situation on him almost more than any other individual in this state. And I'm talking both long-term and short-term. He deserved to be run out of office, and it'll be a sad day if he ever gets any credit for anything he did.
You know, what's interesting is it seems to me the worst thing you can do if have excess revenue as a government.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That doesn't look like that works out well.
And, you know, they've tried various sorts of controls to try and stop the incentive to spend all that money immediately. Unfortunately, the very people who make the lockbox are the very same people who want to leave a back door so they can sneak in there when they want to. And so it becomes very complicated to set something up that would actually work. I don't know. There's no easy solution. There's no doubt about it.
Do you see, we have about 3.5 minutes left. Any big changes to real estate coming in the next few years with policy changes as mortgage deductions, things like that?
It's hard to say. I would have liked to have seen Fannie and Freddie removed from the scene, but again, that seems to have died in the vine, and it's likely they're not going anywhere. The mortgage deduction should go away, candidly. It doesn't do anything for anybody. The only people who gain from that were the people who own homes when it first went into place. Otherwise, the rest of us just paying more for the house, and that's the only offsetting effect. That should go away. It's a ridiculous thing to have, but again, it's so fundamentally popular, I have trouble seeing it going away. Sadly enough, you're seeing securitization of mortgages starting to grow and occur again. And so I look across the board, and sadly, we don't seem to have learned much from this crisis, have we?
No, we want our house to go up at all costs, it looks like.
Yeah, and so I don't know. For me, it's frustrating to see that we have learned so little, but perhaps this time we'll at least be able to see the signs of impending doom a little better, and maybe we'll be able to head it off of the path a little more effectively.
Well, you know, one thing that when you have a very low interest policy, it's great if you're a borrower, but if you're a saver, that hasn't turned out very well.
Yeah, I want to take exception with what you just said.
Okay, good.
Interest rates, these long-term interest rates are not a function of policy. This is nothing Obama or Bernanke did. Quantitative easing 1, quantitative easing 2. Economists who've done studies say maybe it's reduced interest rates by 0.3%, 0.4% maximum. These interest rates are low because there's a lot more supply of capital in the world today than there is demand. Simple as that. And that's not going to change anytime in the near term. Which means for those people out there thinking ahead, planning about their future, they need to understand that ultimately the best way of saving for the future is to spend less, because the yields just aren't going to be there the way they were in the past.
Now, just to clarify, and get about a minute left, the Fed's buying a lot of the debt at this point. Isn't that correct? Or the Treasury? Or
not
the Treasury?
Much. I mean, they're putting, $40 billion a month in? But again, interest rates are low, again, ultimately because there's a lot more supply of capital in the world today than there is demand. Simple as that.
Okay.
There's all sorts of work done showing that, you know, the actual impact the Federal Reserve can have on long-term rates is much less than what we would typically think, given the tone of the news. This really is a market-driven situation.
Well, Christopher, we got 30 seconds, and I've never heard you give me a 30-second answer, so I'm just going to say I really appreciate you taking the time. I see your speaking schedule. I know you're very busy, and we're going to miss you on the panel this year because it's always fun to watch you get into it with some of the panelists.
Yeah, I've missed the last couple of years. You always come to me at a time when I am engaged elsewhere, but I'm hoping I can get there maybe next year.
Okay.
Just give me a date early.
All right, we'll do that right away. All right, Christopher,
all right.
Thanks a lot for joining us.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Adrenaline Athletics, Caldwell Banker Pioneer Real Estate, Elite Auctions, FIBI for Home Investors by Investors, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts Incorporated, Keller Williams of Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Board of Realtors, Stars Photography, UDirect IRA, Wilson Investment Properties, Tony Alvarez, Weston South Coast Plaza. See iSurvivedRealEstate.com for more on the event and all of the I Survived Real Estate sponsors.